Welcome to the Daily Bolster. Each day, we welcome transformational executives to share their real-world experiences and practical advice about scaling yourself, your team, and your business.
Welcome to the Daily Bolster. I'm Matt Blumberg, co-founder and CEO of Bolster, and I'm here today with Jess Hunt. Jess is a senior technology operating executive. She is an independent board member and a CEO advisor. She has a lot of experience working in some really interested talent-oriented marketplaces, which we're going to talk about today. Jess, welcome to the Daily Bolster.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
Yes. So I love doing these Friday interviews because I get to walk with someone through their career. And I feel like you learn so much when you sort of take that journey with someone and understand not just sort of how they got, where they got, and why, but what were the things that they brought from one thing to another.
Oh, I love it. I agree.
So my research on you begins at Gerson Lehman Group. And I don't know if there's a chapter before that that was missing from LinkedIn.
Well, it was grad school. The chapter before that was grad school. I was studying to be a human paleontologist all through my 20s.
Okay. What is a human?
It has almost nothing to do with the rest of our conversation.
I don't know if that's right. If you worked in labor marketplaces, what is a human paleontologist?
I was studying human evolution, specifically, you know, early hominid evolution. So when our ancestors started to walk on two legs. So I studied fossils.
Okay. So now I'll ask, how did you get from that to not academia? Because there's really only one thing you do with that.
I had the good luck of overlapping in school with some of GLG's founders. And I left academia knowing I wasn't going to cut it. And I was lucky enough to get an entry-level position at what was a very interesting startup in the late 90s and early aughts in New York City. And it was an internet-based, you know, non-MarTech startup that was an early talent marketplace.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of GLG. I have gotten to know in different ways over time G and L, but actually years after they, I think, had both left the business. In a lot of ways, GLG is a good comparable for the first part of the Bolster business model, the marketplace for fractional executives. But talk a little bit about your time there. I think when you left, you were either running sales or you had a very senior executive role. It sounds like you were entry level to begin with.
That's right.
Talk a little bit about your rise there and also kind of how that coincided with the rise of the business. The one thing I've never known about that business is, was it an overnight success or was it one of those companies that took, you know, 10 years to become an overnight success?
Well, I wasn't there the first couple of years. I joined and I'm sure that I wasn't one of the first 50 employees or even 75 employees. And so I imagine it as an overnight success. Certainly we got big quickly in the first couple of years, and we also became profitable rather quickly and had some really interesting inquiries to buy us. We were building a new category that was an alternative to sell side research. And so we were creating a category and we were doing, you know, we were a challenger and, it felt that was a heck of a lot of fun. And I think we were unusually successful in the beginning. We'll have to ask G&L about that.
What made the business tick? Like, did it turn something that wasn't an organized marketplace into an organized marketplace? Did it create demand for something new? Was it a little bit of both?
My perception is that we had product market fit very early, and the market that we were in were ready buyers with relatively big budgets for what we were selling. So
that sounds like a good formula right there.
I mean, you can get that. We were also over time it didn't feel like it in the moment, but we ultimately benefited from the regulatory environment, which was expecting certain compliance from our customers and from our platform. And we invested heavily in being independent, not part of a bank. And we invested in compliance. So I think we made a lot of good decisions in the first 5 to 10 years about the kind of platform we were building. And then we benefited from the internet. LinkedIn came along while we were, 6, 7 years old. And we were using note cards in the beginning. I think they're probably framed in the office somewhere now. The way in which you could find people at the end of the 90s and the early aughts benefited us a heck of a lot. So we were lucky in that regard.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I had never thought about the compliance element to that business, and it reminds me of something that I want to ask you about. So one of my mentors, someone I worked for years ago at Moviefone, used to say that people bought products along what he called the fear-greed continuum.
Oh yeah,
and that you could buy things because you know, were afraid to, you had to. You could buy things because they were going to make you more money or make you, you know, look better or whatnot. And the best businesses are the ones where you had both. Did you also have both?
I don't know that I've ever had such a fear-greed combination in any business I've worked on since, because there was certainly an element of, you know, show, you were able to say, here are the hedge funds that are working with us now. Wouldn't you like to be one of them? And that was probably more effective there than any other business. And of course, I've been in sales and marketing for a really long time in any business since.
Yeah, but compliance, you know, compliance is something that will just make people make decisions about things,
right?
Because they feel like they have to.
Right.
So that's interesting. So now, many years later, you've worked at lots of other different places. Have you ever used GLG as a client?
I have, and I'm also an expert in the network, and I occasionally do phone calls.
I have done one or two of those over the years, and they're always interesting because they're just kind of random.
They are random. I mean, this is the thing about labor marketplaces, is that labor marketplaces, if you're a part of the supply side of a labor marketplace, your experience can be a lot wonkier than if you're on the paying side, on the customer right. side. And, you know, I'm sure you're learning, you see this at Bolster. And that's true for every labor marketplace I've worked on.
Yeah. Okay. So from GLG, the next yes. step in your career was at Axiom Legal.
That's right.
And Axiom Legal was actually like one of the original labor marketplaces,
yes.
and trying to bring that to lawyers.
That's right.
One of the things that I always really admired about Axiom, and we were a client of Axiom's right after they got started at ReturnPath. We used Axiom for a couple of things.
Oh, cool.
I thought what was so interesting that they did was they basically productized a service. And when I think about labor marketplaces, successful high-end labor marketplaces, they're really good at productizing a service. So I'd love to hear about your time there. And does that resonate as one of the success factors?
Yes. And it reminds me of something. So at GLG, it was one of those experiences where you're at a startup, and I was there for the better part of 10 years, and I got to make a lot of mistakes and wear a lot of different hats, but mostly I became a sales leader, a sales and marketing leader, and a general manager there. Helped to build the enterprise business. And, you know, that's sort of all the businesses I've been working on since have been enterprise businesses. at Axiom, I was, you know, really ready for it. At that time, Axiom and GLG were about the same age, but Axiom was actually, I think maybe by then it was bigger. And so I took a job to have a bigger P&L and more people, and scale was really important to me. By then I felt like I had some functional expertise, and I wanted to put it to use. So that was great. But I learned a lot at Axiom. And one of the things that I reflect on that Axiom got right was brand. And I think that's related to your point about productization. If you called, I did lots of research before I joined Axiom, and I would call customers, anyone I could find. And ReturnPath would have been an odd customer at that point, because we were mainly working for large enterprise. So we were innovators on so many things.
Yeah.
And, you know, you called a customer, and Axiom as a service was so locatable for them, which is really interesting because it's legal. I mean, their legal tech has changed a lot, but I mean, at that time, to have such a strong brand was something that the founder and CEO and a founding team were really deliberate about and invested a heck of a lot in. And I think I probably, to be honest, took brand for granted until that point. I think I probably thought my investments in brand were potentially wasted, or at least half of them are, as the saying goes. And I don't take that for granted anymore.
Yeah. It's a really good point. I think, I also think there's something about being known as the first brand in something, or a pioneering brand. And Axiom really was, you know, in obviously not the first law firm, right, or not the first collection right. of lawyers, but they brought that notion of you know, sort of lawyers on demand, you know, through on a platform to the world.
Right. It was also on the supply side, it was a really interesting alternative path for attorneys. I mean, we had hundreds and then eventually thousands of attorneys. And if you're an attorney that doesn't want to work at a big firm and wants more flexibility than in-house, I mean, especially primary caregivers in certain stages right. of their life, Axiom is a terrific, terrific path.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually that was our use case. So we had, you know, we had essentially our general counsel, but we didn't need a full-time general counsel. And it was a mom who was, you know, extraordinary lawyer, caregiver, and she ended up coming in-house after many years, but in-house in a more flexible way, because we still didn't need full-time. So
fractional labor. We too are believers.
Going to be big. So let's talk about Andela. Andela, you know, in some ways, it's a similar business, but actually quite different in a lot of ways. And, you know, why don't you actually tell people first what Andela is? Because I think it may be less well-known than the other two. And a little bit about, you know, the things you did there over time.
Sure. Andela is a company that offers fantastic software development talent to companies on an outsourced basis, but it feels insourced. And today, Axiom is talent, software talent all over the world, but Axiom's heritage is in Africa. Andela's heritage is in Africa. So we started in Nigeria. And by the time I joined, I think we were in 4 countries. And so we benefited from remote work. We benefited from technology and the flexibility that software teams and certainly technology companies have to work with talent all over the world. And so we believe there were such big pools of extraordinary talent in places in the world, especially in the African countries we were operating in, to offer exciting opportunities for that talent and to offer exciting talent to software companies, primarily in the US, but also in Europe.
Yeah, so this is a parallel to my last comment about Axiom. So Bolster is actually an Andela client. We've had a great experience with Andela. We have 3 engineers in Nigeria and 1 in Kenya, and have for 3 years. So it's been a good experience for us. The one thing I always was a little confused about is I seem to remember when we started working with Andela, the positioning was that they were a marketplace, but I haven't experienced as a client them as a marketplace so much as just, you know, really high quality engineering staffing. How was the business one and then it became the other? Is it a little of both? Are there different models?
I think it is a marketplace. And you know, you always have to be careful when you talk about marketplace business models and human talent. But just like you said before at Axiom, the offering is such that if you're an end user, if you're a customer, you either have a great team that is a part of your company, or you have great individual talent that is a part of your team. And so that would be how you would experience it, ideally. The business model itself, the operating model, looks like some of these other talent marketplaces we've been talking about.
Oh, interesting. But people aren't, I mean, clients aren't in and out of there. Like, I mean, it's so different from GLG where you're getting someone for 30 minutes, right? Oh, I think we've had engineers from Andela for 3 years.
Right.
So
that's right. But companies can scale up and scale down, do project-based work with Andela. I think yours, I mean, it sounds like your experience has been ideal. If you've got fantastic talent that you want to hang on to and that wants to hang on to you, that's where we'd certainly like to go. And that's the best economics for any marketplace.
Yeah. Like I said, we've had a great experience with it. You know, the one thing that's challenging with that model, like GLG, you hire someone, you talk to them once, you never expect to talk to them again. You know, our culture is very people oriented, and you know, we care a lot about sort of the growth and development of people on the team, et cetera, et cetera. When someone's a contractor, it's a little bit harder to make that work, and when they're a contractor on another continent, it's even harder.
Right.
So you know, we have, for example, once a year we get the whole company together in person. because we live in a bunch of different places, and we literally can't bring them because of like travel visa issues. So there's some things that end up being, you know, a little bit disconnected. But yeah, I mean, they've been tremendous parts of the team.
And I mean, I will say that, and at Andela, we invested a lot to make sure that for those who could travel, for the engineers who could travel, that they were allotted one trip a year, at least one trip a year, where they would be, you know, in person for 2 weeks with their teams. And so
you were there before COVID though, right?
Yes.
Yeah, I think a lot of things are different.
I agree.
And then, so the next step in your career after that is what you're doing now, which is fractional work, advisory work, board work.
That's right.
What led you to make that jump? And can you ever see going back to doing full-time executive work?
Right. Well, first of all, I mean, like you, I'm a big believer in fractional labor. And I hear when people are far enough in their careers, they talk about a portfolio. And I suppose that I'm closer to that than I am as an operator. I'm also an operating partner at a growth equity firm called Long Ridge with $2 billion under management, focused on business tech and fintech. And that's also an important part of my portfolio. So I kind of look at myself right now as enjoying the portfolio while it lasts, but I am definitely not finished operating. I really do encourage people to, operators like me, I'm not a founder, I'm not an entrepreneur, to do board work, to do not necessarily advising, but look for these kinds of opportunities to expand your perspective and continue learning past your functional expertise. And I've certainly found that to be true of some of the work I'm doing right now.
So what, you know, your ideal next role is?
I think I want to operate again.
In what capacity? Do you want to be, you know, on the selling side? Do you want to be more of a, you know, COO, president, CEO? Could you ever found something?
The latter. Oh man, I don't have the ideas. I really love working with teams, especially founders. And I've almost exclusively worked with only founder CEOs in my career. And I love being next door to that energy, shoulder to shoulder with someone who has a vision. And I really enjoy being the person that helps to carry the vision, but is all about the how and reaching the potential of the vision. And I know that about myself.
Well, it is important to know what you like and what you don't like and what you're good
totally.
At. Good at. So,
totally.
All right. So probably my last question for you, unless it leads to another one, is when you approach so you are an operator, right? As you said,
yes.
Now you're doing advisory work. And how do you approach that? So, you know, adding value on the outside is different than adding value on the inside. How did you learn how to approach it? How do you approach it? Is it more of a push model with you or a pull model? How do you make sure you're giving great advice, but you actually own the outcome?
I do some advising, but I would actually say I most of the work, the advising type work I do, I'd like to do through board work. So I've been
on board, right? You don't own the outcome.
So on board work, one of the things I've learned is I know what I'm, if you can kind of take stock and know what you can bring to the table, you find opportunities where they really need what you have to offer. I think the least good board experience I had nothing to do with a great company and the board. It was the fact that they didn't really need or could put to work what I had to offer. So it just wasn't high value for anybody. The second thing is I really do look for learning opportunities and the quality of the investors. And if we have a shared understanding of the investment thesis, even though you have common shares and you're an independent board member, is so important. And if you can sit at a board on a board for years with really talented individuals who are parts of really great firms, I mean, I think it gives a lot of lift. It makes you a better operator, really expands your perspective. So those are the kinds of things I look for. And I'm actually looking forward to doing that hopefully for the rest of my career. And I also encourage my team members to do advising and board work and come back and bring what you've learned back to us. I don't mind if you take a few hours a month to go do those things. I think it's a net positive for what for our operation.
I think that's such a good point. I tell CEOs that all the time. They should every CEO should sit on someone else's board if they can. And it's great for any operating executive to advise another business. You learn, you get as much out of it as they do.
That's right.
So, and that's a great note to close on. So Jess Hunt, thank you for talking to me today. I am glad to have gotten to know you over the last couple of years and really look forward to watching your career as it continues its next few chapters.
Thank you, Matt. It was a pleasure.